You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. You're watching Culturally Determined, and my name is Arya Cohen-Wade, and my guest today is Freddie DeBoer. Freddie, could you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Freddie DeBoer. I read a lot of different places.
Right. So probably Blogging Heads fans know you and recognize you, and you occasionally participate in the comment section of Blogging Heads. They probably super fans know you from there too. So we have a couple topics we want to talk about today. And kind of the original reason, and here my cat is indeed jumping up to say hi. The original reason that we were going to talk, was kind of like talk about the Sanders campaign and how the media is covering the Sanders campaign. And is like Sanders getting like a bad deal from the media or like a good deal from the media. And so what are your thoughts on this?
So, I mean, look, there are certainly people, I think, within the media who are kind of explicitly and unknowingly trying to undermine the Bernie Sanders campaign, because that's sort of like, you know, they have a particular kind of partisan desire to see Hillary Clinton win. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is, right. It's important to sort of know how to put this, which is that all media is biased. Right. And we don't want the view from nowhere. Journalistic objectivity is a something that is a kind of a bogus idea in and of itself. Mm-hmm. What you want to do, you know, what we want from journalists is not that they sort of try to occupy some sort of stance of fake, complete, perfect objectivity, but that they accurately report the facts as best that they understand them and that they give equal time to different points of view. That being said, I do think that the media, so what happens is that the media maintains the pretense of bias, and then the ways in which they are of being unbiased, and then the ways in which they are biased kind of become more pernicious because of that. But I don't doubt that there are some people in the media who are sort of openly polling for Hillary. I think that the problem is that you have certain structural reasons within the media why they are functionally biased towards Hillary Clinton without intending to be, right? So it's not like I don't think that like the crew at Fox or at Slate or
maybe at Fox. New York,
well, at Vox.
Oh, at Vox. Fox.com. Yeah. So Fox, yeah. Fox News, Vox.com, very different. Fox News, right. It does not operate like a normal news organization. So, okay, yeah, Vox, right. Slate, Salon, these other sites.
Or even like the New York Times, mm-hmm. right? So like yesterday or the other day, the New York Times described Bernie Sanders' victory over Hillary as being much smaller than that of Ted Cruz over Trump, even though they ended up being exactly the same, like, okay. It was like within like a half a percentage point.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't think that's because like, I don't think that the New York Times sits down and says to itself, we're going to have pro Bernie Sanders coverage, but rather that there are certain elements of like the way that the media operates that has baked into it a tendency to gravitate towards establishment politicians from establishment parties.
Yeah.
And in a really powerful way, the mainstream media reflects the biases of establishment parties, and establishment parties are always going to be biased towards corporatism and at least on the Democrat side towards centrism, to a triangulation, to Clintonism, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So,
but functionally, do I think that in some ways Bernie Sanders is getting a raw deal? Yeah. I mean, you know, you can track this if you can look at like the kind of coverage he's received over the course of the primary, and he's received coverage that was favorable as long as he was perceived as being no threat, mm-hmm. which he was kind of treated as this kind of like harmless and benign socialist uncle.
Yeah.
As soon as he became like a legitimate threat to win the nomination, that's when the knives came out. And you had this period of 6 weeks. And within a couple of weeks there, where I've never seen such an intense sort of oppo dump done on a mainstream politician by the mainstream media. And it was, just issue after issue and idea after idea, where there was this panicky sense that, oh, you know, we have to go after this guy. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't think that the New York Times sat down to say, let's screw this, or even the Washington Post, which has been awful, their opinion page. It's their version of the world, right? looks the way that Hillary Clinton's version of the world looks.
Yeah.
Because both Hillary and the Washington Post editorial page reflect a certain kind of socioeconomic perspective that benefits the already comfortable.
Okay. Yeah, I think I agree with most of that. I don't know if Bernie has been – I mean, look how the media is treating Trump. Like, it's this crazy relationship where they're kind of like almost addicted to the drug of his – the kind of media craziness he brings with him. And like people just want to see what he's going to do next. But also like, you know, the New York Times is calling him a misogynist like in non-opinion articles. So you know, it's, I don't want to call it unprecedented, but I kind of largely agree with what you're saying. But I guess just the point I was making is also kind of a, a vulgar Marxist kind of point. I had a previous conversation on Blogging Heads with this guy, John Ziegler, who's a very interesting guy who is a conservative talk radio host, or kind of formally profiled by David Foster Wallace famously in an article called Host. And he's kind of become a conservative dissident, or the way I was saying it, getting back to our Marxist theme, he is like someone who escaped from the Soviet Union in 1935 and is telling his story of what it is actually like behind the Iron Curtain, except the Iron Curtain is the conservative media. But, you know, the incentive for any media person is to get traffic, clicks, and ratings. And competition and, you know, people who are energized fuel that. And Obama versus Clinton 2008 was great for the web. And it was great for Blogging Heads, in fact. We had, you know, the maybe this is telling tales out of school, but the one of the biggest traffic days in Blogging Heads history was the day after Sarah Palin was announced as the vice president. And I don't even know what the Blogging Heads episode was up that day, but we had someone talking about it, and people just wanted to know who this person was and what was going on. And so that kind of stuff just really drives media coverage. And the media is very happy. I mean, I think that the people in the media would be happier if Hillary Clinton wins, but they don't want Bernie Sanders to drop out right now because it becomes boring if he drops out. They want a contested convention in Cleveland. I don't think there isn't going to be a contested convention for the Democrats, but they want conflict. They want people to say, what's going on? I have to turn on CNN right now to find out what's going on. This is kind of like an economic determinist like view, or like a vulgar Marxist view, maybe. Like, what do you think about that?
No, I think that's true. I think the media is addicted to spectacle. That's for sure. But I mean, even in the way in which they're covering, like, you know, people have pulled out. There's the sort of. So to talk about like media bias, right? So one of the things that's frustrating is to say that the media has like a liberal bias depends on what you mean by liberal, right? So the media does not have and has never had an economically left-wing bias, right?
Right.
The media has a sort of culturally and socially sort of biased sort of bias in the sense that it is made up of the kind of people for whom a certain kind of socially and culturally liberal vocabulary is presumed to be the default of all good people, right?
Right.
And that emerges from going to exclusive liberal arts colleges and schools that are hard to get into, which a very tiny percentage of the country's population goes to, and where, you know, if you emerge from Oberlin or Yale or Sarah Lawrence or wherever,
I emerged from Yale. Okay. with an English degree.
Yeah. If you immerse from those places and you want to go into the world of cosmopolitan, urbane kind of post-collegiate life, and there's a certain kind of way in which you're expected to talk about the world, it is a mistake to think of that as a left-wing way of talking about the world.
Right.
It is kind of sort of culturally in a very vague and sort of toothless sense liberal, but it is not married to a particular kind of left-wing attitude.
Right. Okay, just to clarify terms. So this has kind of come up online sometimes. I mean, we say like the conservative movement or the right, and I think everyone kind of understands what that means. But if we say the left, you know, or the liberals or the progressives, you know, those are not all the same thing. Whereas like saying the right and the conservative movement is basically the same thing. So when I say the left, like who is in the left to you? Like, is Hillary Clinton in the left?
All right. So let's define terms. Yeah. I'll do it both the polite and the impolite way. Okay. There is a broad left of center. So if we imagine such a thing as a perfect sort of political median in the United States, then yes, Hillary Clinton is on the left of center. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama is to the left of center, right? We then have this confusion of terms, which number one, so like liberal is a term that has for a long time been used to reflect a kind of economically and socially and culturally left-wing perspective in certain ways, in the sense, again, like of being left of center. Progressive has also been used in that way, in part because liberal started to have sort of bad branding, right?
Yeah.
But we need to take care to distinguish liberals and progressives from like what I think of as the left wing. So the left wing is based on the idea that capitalism cannot be reformed, that you can't achieve a just society from more and better capitalism, that you can't simply sort of tweak the earned income tax credit and, you know, sort of work for meritocracy and create an economically just system from sort of business as usual in terms of our basic sort of economic sort of solution. Mm-hmm. Liberals tend to be people who are reformists who think that the problems with capitalism can be solved with a more ethical kind of a capitalism. So, for example, if you look at like FDR, right? FDR did a lot of good things and a lot of bad things.
Yeah.
Like interning Japanese people.
Yeah. Agreed.
But FDR is kind of part of like a sort of classically liberal kind of American sort of tradition, because the fundamental sort of appeal of the New Deal is that it is again, this is sort of pejorative, but people like me call it pity charity liberalism, right? Okay. Which means that you establish government redistributive policies that no doubt have many positive impacts in the world, right? Like I'm happier to have the New Deal than to not have it. I'm happy to have Social Security and Medicare, and I will defend those things. Uh-huh. But fundamentally, they involve a political deal where the government gives you these benefits. That is actually a more conservative alternative to what was happening before.
Right.
Part of the reason why the New Deal happened was that in the first half of the 20th century, the American labor movement transformed the working world. I mean, it was the American labor movement. You know, so May Day, for example, people don't know this. May Day is specifically a celebration of the American labor movement. Mm-hmm. Because the American labor movement won a ton of major concessions from capital through their militancy, through strikes, through their willingness to really battle with capital. That's threatening to someone like FDR, right? Roosevelt, who was
very wealthy himself, you know, a kind of blue blood.
A very wealthy blue blood, you know, kind of guy. Hmm. And so the New Deal and that kind of liberalism is a sort of a more conservative way of sort of achieving the ends that the American socialist and labor movement won. You know, the labor movement won things like 8-hour workday and power within the workplace and the weekend and finally put the nail in the coffin of child labor and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Now, depending on the kind of socialist that you might be, people like me think that, in fact, that like that's the point of liberalism, right? Like liberalism exists to undercut a muscular kind of like sort of labor left or okay. a socialist left, mm-hmm. right? So in that sense, someone like Hillary is a kind of classic liberal in the sense that she favors a negotiation between capital and labor that sometimes does result in beneficial programs for labor, but that is always waged on capital's terms.
Okay. So. Yeah. So something that I think is said about FDR, I mean, what's weird about this is that, you know, this is kind of an alternate reading from the traditional reading of the New Deal, but then you also have this conservative reading of the New Deal that's like, you know, FDR was a socialist and this is all like a plot to enslave people. So then you have all these like people are like speaking different languages, but like, so one way of understanding the New Deal is, you know, FDR saved capitalism from itself. And like, you know, we saw what happened in Europe. And after the Great Depression, almost every country in Europe descended into communism or fascism. And, you know, this was like, and so like Roosevelt like pioneered like a third way where you didn't, people wanted an American fascist. Some people wanted an American fascist in 1932, as you probably know. And he did not do that. And if in 1932, we can imagine alternate history, and probably someone has written the novel where, like, the military, like, grants, you know, comes to Roosevelt and says, like, you know, we are granting you ultimate power, and the Congress is like, okay, for, like, you know, the next year, you have dictatorial powers, and, like, because we're in such a hole right now, and, you know, something plays out that's much like stranger and uglier than what actually happened. And so Roosevelt saved, in my view, as a, someone who thinks of himself as a liberal or a progressive and not a leftist, like Roosevelt, like saved capitalism, saved democracy, saved the world because he won World War II and is like a great hero. And like after Lincoln is the greatest American president. So, you know, that's just where I'm coming from. And, you know, this is, so I'm not a leftist, but I think what's also weird is that, you know, a lot of the way the mainstream media reports on it, like everything is lumped together, you know,
right.
Socialist, progressive, liberal, leftist, it's all kind of one thing. And then you have like the conservative counter narrative of, you know, liberal fascism, you know, the Glenn Beck kind of, you know, Woodrow Wilson, like fooled everyone into embracing, you know, this right. progressive ideology. So we have all this bullshit out there. And so it's like complex and confusing.
Right. So if we're going to look through this lens of like dividing, of acknowledging that liberals and leftists aren't the same in many really fundamental ways.
Yeah.
I think it is important to say that, you know, although I get lumped in as a Bernie supporter a lot because I'm always fighting with Hillary fans, Bernie isn't far from my ideal candidate. And among other things, he's not really a socialist, right?
Okay, right.
I mean, maybe he is deep down in his heart, but in terms of what he actually, his agenda does not include actual socialism because mm-hmm. actual socialism depends. Like to sort of the minimum requirement of calling you a socialist is that you have to believe in community ownership of the productive apparatus of society, right?
Okay.
So what Marx called seizing the modes of production.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree that, you know, to what we actually seize, whether that involves the abolition of private property, which in fact, you know, many people will tell you Marx was not in fact in favor of, what there is to seize in a digital economy like we have right now is a series of complicated questions.
Yeah. Do you call yourself a socialist or a democratic socialist or just a straight socialist?
I'm a socialist. I'm a democratic socialist in the sense that like I am not one of these Marxists who thinks that like that freedom of speech is like an outmoded bougie concept. I don't believe that. No.
Okay.
So in a sense, I'm a democratic socialist. Sure.
Okay. So let's bring in your kind of possible bait noir, but someone who in our last conversation you agreed with in some respects, who is maybe you can guess, Jonathan Chait. And so he wrote this piece that pissed off a lot of people on the left, at least on Twitter, which is where I get most of my political news these days, right. About, you know, Marxism has always failed because it will inevitably fail. And we'll link to the piece. You can probably maybe summarize it better than I can. But it was along the lines of there's something inherent in Marxism that denies fundamental rights because it places economic rights ahead of individual liberty rights that liberals believe in. And, you know, there's a reason that every Marxist, you know, country where Marxists have seized power has devolved into a dictatorship. It's not a strange coincidence. It's embedded in Marxist belief. So is that an accurate summary of what you think Chait is arguing, and how would you respond to that?
I think that's an accurate summary of what Chait is saying. I think there's a few things we want to say. First, number one is Chait always does this, which is that despite his obsession with Marxists and leftists and, you know, and hippie punching, in a really fundamental way, he does not understand the left because he's forever lumping in identity politics with Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
So he complains about college campus protesters, and then he calls them Marxists, right? In fact, identitarians, people who sort of practice identity politics, and Marxists, or, you know, or real socialists, real left, sort of economic leftists in that way, that's one of the oldest and ugliest and still very active fights in sort of in left-wing politics, right? Mm-hmm. Those groups hate each other, right? And he lumps them all together because he's just not very careful in how he analyzes these things. Now, in terms of like...
Okay, but is this a reference I've made like 10 times in the past 2 months. Is this Judean People's Front, People's Front of Judea? Is this
no,
like...
No, it's not.
Okay,
no,
can you explain like the difference here?
Okay, well, this is going to get into a whole big thing. So somebody recently tweeted that class solidarity is for white people, right?
Seriously, or they tweeted this seriously, or as a joke?
They tweeted that seriously. Okay. So there is a divide that it's live now on Twitter, but it goes back to very old divisions about what's the best way to confront problems like sexism and racism. there is a critique of economic reductionism, which posits that there are people in the world who see racism and sexism as nothing more than epiphenomena of classism, that like racism and sexism are just classism or problems of classism.
So I guess this is, in some ways, I think Bernie kind of does do this. I mean, so one thing that, you know, he kind of thinks like, okay, once there's the political revolution and the power for, like the corporate media that he is obsessed with, and like if we have campaign finance reform, so he said this thing that was written about today, and we'll find the link, that was like the conservative, you know, once we break the power of like, you know, the conservative and the corporate like infrastructure, like the there will only 10% of Americans would like vote for the Republican Party, because like they're kind of like they have like a false consciousness. And so once we like deal with the economic issues, like everything will flow from that, and you don't have to like tackle sexism and racism as they are. They're like does that, am I explaining this correctly?
I think that that's an exaggeration of what Bernie actually said. Okay. I will concede that he was not very articulate in that point. Mm-hmm. What I want to point out is that I know every kind of commie. Okay, like I was born into socialism, and I have a very left wing network both in real life and online. And I know all kinds of Trotskyists and Leninists and Maoists and honest to God Stalinists, like self-proclaimed Stalinists.
Okay.
I do not know a single person who says that racism is just a function of class.
Okay.
Who says that sexism is just a function of class. That is a stereotype of sort of Marxist position. What people like me say is that the most effective means, the most likely means we have of fighting racism and sexism is to attack their economic roots. Of course, racism is a wholly unique problem that's not just the same as classism. Of course, sexism is a unique problem that's not just the same as classism, and just attacking them economically won't solve all of our problems. But the most likely way to actually improve the lives of women and of people of color is to remove their economic problems, is to make, put them on an economic equal footing, because then they will enjoy economic and political power, and then they can secure their own best interests, right?
Yeah.
So it's not that racism is just classism, or sexism is just classism. And it's not that socialism will solve those problems, but that by putting everyone on an equal plane of economically and politically, then they can secure their own best interests.
Okay, I think that makes sense, and that's certainly better than how Bernie put it, or maybe better than even he understands it. And so you must really hate it when you have this kind of, what we really need is a national conversation about race. So that must drive you up the wall, right? So this is kind of like the classic Clinton, you know, nothingism, because we've had the conversation about race for 20 years, and not much has been learned, or even if something has been learned, not much has changed, I guess is the better way to put it.
Well, I mean, I've written about this many times. So I would argue that objectively, anti-black racism, so if you compare black Americans to the country as a whole, and particularly to white Americans, racial inequality. So in other words, in terms of what's measurable and how black and white people are different economically in this country, and in terms of all kinds of like life satisfaction things. So literacy rate, life expectancy, likelihood to have health insurance, things like that. Black Americans are worse today than they were in 1980, right? But things are actually worse than they were 35 years ago. And I can show you all kinds of charts and graphs to kind of demonstrate that. My read on American race relations is that we have these periods, right? And obviously slavery is a big one. And then in the post-slavery world, we have slavery by any other name for a while. Then we have the period of Jim Crow and segregation. Then we have the civil rights movement, and many of the major impediments of civil rights are sort of torn down. And the civil rights movement was incomplete. It didn't go far enough, and then had some failures. But the civil rights movement really did dramatically improve the quality of life for people of color. And you can actually look, again, like just talking about racial inequality in its most obvious and observable forms, we can look on charts and graphs and see the relative condition of people of color improving over time. that improvement stops around 1980, somewhere around the Reagan Revolution. We hit a plateau.
Right. And there's a lot of stuff that people put 1979 as a weird marker that I don't quite understand why. So it's obviously like, that would be 2 years before Reagan was inaugurated. No, right. Like what Krugman writes is about, like, you know, like that's kind of when, what is the term? Like the wage increase and the, not efficiency, what's the term I'm searching for? Like how efficient people
productivity.
Are. Yeah, the productivity and wages like diverged in 1979. A bunch of weird things happened in 1979. Is this concurrent with that kind of weird split that no one quite understands yet?
I certainly think that Reagan. So I think you have a few things. So you have the sort of like, yes, it's true that this begins prior to specific Reagan administration, but that you do have this kind of Reagan revolution, this building kind of Republican revolution, mm-hmm. this new conservatism, which was inspired in part by stagflation. And indeed, there were a lot of problems economically in the 70s. But there you have, I think, a couple different things going on. I think it's indisputable that the era of small government, the Reagan Revolution, hurt people who were most dependent upon government intervention in the economy, and that included people of color. But also, you know, I think rhetorically and politically, we had the switch where the civil rights movement was not about hearts and minds, right? I mean, this is one of the big misconceptions. Like the civil rights movement was not a big success because, you know, people started to care about each other. It wasn't about changing people's feelings. It wasn't about making white people love black people.
Right.
It was about securing material differences, material change. So the Voting Rights Act said, okay, we can't trust the local sheriff to make sure that black people's voting rights are respected. So we're going to make it a federal crime. And we literally sent federal marshals to make sure that black people got to vote, right? The Equal Housing Authority is not about like making people love black people, right? It's not about like us joining hands in the Rainbow Coalition. It's about saying, if you don't rent to black people, if you don't sell houses to black people, we'll send men with guns to make sure that you do, right?
Okay, so you need the power of the state. You need, you know, the state's power, the state's monopoly on violence in order to enforce some of these things to combat the legacy of American racism.
Right. And so by the time I am in school, by the time I'm an elementary school student in the late 1980s, that has completely changed, where the focus has shifted from being about we need to use the power of the government to insist on and enforce racial equality. And it has instead changed to we need all to not be racist in our hearts, right? And we need to all love each other and come together as a community, and that will ensure racial equality. And it turns out that that doesn't work, right?
Right.
Because racism is not a problem of mind, right? Like racism is not a problem of how people feel. Racism is baked into the institutions and the structures of our economy. It's mm-hmm. baked into our political system. It's baked into our judicial system by like a lot. And so when we switched our focus from attacking racism through like structural means of changing the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Equal Housing Authority, affirmative action, all these programs to attack actual like structural racism within our society. And we shifted to a focus on let's all be nice and love each other and read, you know, children's books about Martin Luther King. That coincided with an overall conservative revolution in politics and policy,
yeah.
And the result has been stagnated or worsening conditions for people of color in America since.
Right. Okay. I think there's more we can talk about here, but I think this is a great transition point to another possible topic because, okay, so a generation or possibly two generations of young people have been indoctrinated with kind of this, you know, Martin Luther King, he was just a nice man who taught everyone that he had a dream. And, you know, we need to have a national conversation about race. And then it gets into the white privilege stuff and the critical race studies. And it kind of devolves currently into the, you know, you need to check your privilege. You know, this weird incident that happened in, I think, in California of a, like, altercation between a white kid who had dreadlocks and a black male student and a black female student who got into like a shouting match or something. And like these weird online battles that if you spend time on Twitter, you see a lot of, and then this whole thing about being woke. So right. If you want to transition now, so you mentioned an article that I actually hadn't read, but we were, you know, something caught fire online, a weird kind of online political Twitter joke meme where, about, you know, start off where there's been this kind of weird thing where like people are talking about their kids, you know, their kid sees like Donald Trump and the kid is like, mommy, what was that mean man saying or something? Or the kid, there was one with a woman who's claimed that when Bernie Sanders like wagged his finger at Hillary Clinton, as he is apt to do, wagging his finger, you know, she spit at the TV. And then you called out, this. Well, there's one guy who is March his last name? Stephen March, is that it?
Stephen March, I think, from Canada. Yeah.
So he had one of the, kind of a paradigmatic one of these tweets, and we'll link to this piece. And his was something like, you know, my 3-year-old daughter saw a photo of Trump, and said, "Daddy, why is that man so scared?" And I said, "I don't know, sweetheart. I just don't know." And so this is kind of like this performative, like virtue signaling kind of stuff. Like, you know, even my little child can recognize that Donald Trump is really just a scared little child himself. So this kind of politics happens a lot online, especially on Twitter. And then it became this crazy joke, and we'll link to the piece that kind of aggregated a lot of these jokes that weirdly linked to both a joke tweet that you sent out, a joke tweet that I sent out. And so what do you think about this? That was kind of a rambling introduction into this topic.
So I want to be careful about the concept of woke, because some people have rightly claimed that, you know, if you're not careful, I mean, stay woke, which means sort of, you know, stay politically aware and be conscious and know how, you know, the world works.
Yeah. So just to add, this term woke, I didn't even know about it until about 6 weeks ago. And I saw people using it online, maybe some seriously, maybe some not seriously. And I looked it up and started joking about it. And, you know, so this is a pretty recent vintage thing that maybe college kids are talking about. It's kind of a weird slang term that kind of means you are with it, but in like a political sense. So I guess it also possibly has non-political terms, like, or maybe
and
not.
It has, I mean, it has had sometimes sort of association with political conspiracy, right? Like, you know, Bush took down those towers, stay woke or whatever. I want to be careful because some people have pointed out that if you're not careful, because it sort of emerged from sort of black slang, that, you know, it can seem like we're making fun of black people, which is not the case. Woke has come to be to refer to a certain kind of performative and shallow political engagement on a left-wing perspective. And it's particularly associated with, like you say, a performative kind of politics where the purpose is not to kind of sort of reach certain political ends, but to demonstrate to everyone that you are one of the good people who thinks the right things, right? So people now talk about woke, they'll hashtag woke to sort of refer to people like Stephen March, who's like, you know, telling this bizarre fantasy about his daughter having an incredibly kind of his 2-year-old having an incredibly perceptive sort of view of Trump and his policies. You know,
you think that this like did nothing? I mean, we can't know. Do you think like nothing happened at all, or do you think
So March is not getting this out of nowhere. Okay, like he wrote one of the most asinine and bizarre pieces I've ever read about going to a Trump rally, and he talked about seeing it through the eyes of his whiteness. Which I don't even know. Like, it's like you put on like a pair of goggles or something. It's like, oh, through the eyes of my whiteness. And like,
the whole point is you don't have to put the goggles on because they're inside your head.
Well, that's right. That's one of the things that he wrote is that like Trump and Bernie are the same, which is like, yeah, they're the same if like you strip all politics of all of its meaning. Anyway.
Okay. Let's note that for maybe a final topic to talk about the alt-right and the kind of, is there a Bernie Trump connection, but let's just mark that down for maybe a final topic. Sure.
Okay. So look, I've been a critic of a certain kind of politics for a long time. I take a fair amount of heat for that, and that's okay. The left is addicted to a certain kind of performative, linguistic, and symbolic politics that I do not think is actually geared towards securing a better future and a more just and equitable world for us. Mm-hmm. I've been saying for years that there is a growing movement of people who are not impressed with that and who are frustrated with that kind of politics. Mm-hmm. Many of them are afraid to say so because if you are not woke, right, if you don't sort of perform a certain way, then you can be accused of racism, sexism, homophobia. Mm-hmm. But the problems with this kind of engagement are so obvious, and they're being identified more and more by really left-wing people, by Marxists and socialists and whatever, and organizers and activists. But there's a sort of a growing frustration with sort of this kind of politics. And whether it's fair or not, woke has become like a symbol of that sort of thing. So a piece just came out for The All, which we'll link to. It's called Watching the Woke Olympics. And it's by a young writer, and she's a person of color herself, a woman of color. And she talks about observing Twitter and the fact that there is like the Olympics implies like a competition, and that there's a competition, particularly on Twitter and Tumblr, but online, mm-hmm. of white people identifying other white people's political problems, right?
Right.
In particular, racism, right? So one of the sort of white liberals' favorite internet activities is to call other white people racist, right? And one of the points that she makes is that this is not actually an effective means for fighting racism, that even if you accurately condemn someone as racist, like suppose you find someone and they actually are racist and you call them racist, that does not actually reduce the world's amount of racism. Mm-hmm. And that racism has in fact been proven to be a remarkably durable ideology, a remarkable durable problem, right? Mm-hmm. And that one of the things that this does is, like, you know, the woke Olympics, the constant urge to like find people lacking in your eyes, distracts us. It convinces us the problems are easier to solve than they are, right?
Yeah.
Because if racism is like a problem of mind, a personal problem, as she says, well, you just get rid of that person and everything's solved.
Mm-hmm. Or just teach that person. You know, you just you educate them. So that's one of the things you've pointed out, that a lot of this, there's this comic that you've mentioned a couple times. You know, it's mm-hmm. like a little like one page or like one image comic that someone has written about. I mean, you can fill it in, but like it's basically teaching someone like how to identify their own white privilege. And then like the final thing, like the final admonition to the reader of this comic is you need to educate yourself.
Right.
And so the idea is like once you just like learn what you need to do, like, you know, you will realize the error of your ways and like things will be okay. And the last blog is conversation that I had with the writer Ellie Reeve. We talked about kind of the alt-right, and she's written about this, talking about the strange story about the Microsoft chatbot that was imitating a teenager, and that a bunch of kind of trollish people from 4chan and the alt-right, you know, tricked into using racist memes and stuff. So her point was this, is like there are intelligent people out there who are racist. Like they know how to use, there are people out there who are very good at Facebook and Twitter and Photoshop, and they, you know how to use memes, but yet they are racist, anti-Semites, misogynists, and so on and so forth.
But the thing is like when you like, and when we talk about being educated, like the way that you demonstrate that you've absorbed that education is sort of talking with woke terminology yourself,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you would adopt the mannerisms of the dominant social class, and you demonstrate through that, oh, I'm one of the good ones, right? So you start talking about intersectionality.
Right, so so one of the good ones has become like a joke on like this kind of political weird Twitter of like, you know, I'm a white person, but like I'm one of the good ones, you know?
Right. And so this desperate sort of need to sort of demonstrate yourself as being, you know, on the righteous side of humanity sort of being politically good has become completely entangled with being sort of socially popular and culturally aware. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that, like, just as you want to know the right music and wear the right clothes as a sort of bougie, college educated, upwardly mobile, cool white person, you also want to have these signals of being politically aware.
Yeah.
And so becoming that, like, that's the way that you were sort of seen to sort of educate yourself. But as myself and others have been pointing out for a long time, even if you really are feeling those things, then that doesn't change the world. It's not a political program,
yeah.
right? Everybody using the discourse of intersectionality and quoting Howard Zinn does not make the world a better place in and of itself.
Yeah.
But also, like, that makes being, you know, or appearing to be politically conscious very easy to ape, right? Like it becomes just a performance where you can just sort of demonstrate it through saying, like, I'm going to hashtag this and say yes, queen, and use the fire emoji. And so one of the things that we're seeing sort of brings us back to Hillary and Bernie is like actual like left-wing policy, right? Like, should we have single-payer healthcare, which has been an absolutely treasured and fought for and sought after left-wing priority for decades, right? Mm-hmm. Hillary has completely undercut that, said we'll never have, and called it a dream, whatever. That is like a policy debate that's really important. And it has actual like profound consequences for how the left wing will behave in the decades to come. We don't like have a discussion about that. We have a discussion about Bernie Bros, right? And we have Hillary like appearing with the cast of Broad City shouting Slay Queen and like tweeting like the hand clapping emoji and like dabbing on the Ellen show.
And did you see the tweet that she did that was the intersectionality tweet where it was this weird chart? Okay, I'm going to link to this. My joke about that was, you know, it took the team like a full day to come up with this tweet, and it took them so long they had to order in lunch and keep the meeting going to produce this, you know, on a PowerPoint presentation to produce the GIF that they were going to put out there to be like, Hillary, and it just said intersections. So it was like almost like they were like, well, we can't say intersectionality because that's too weird. People don't know what it means. We'll say like intersections, and then the people in the know, the woke people, will get it. Right. And other people won't know what it is and will ignore it.
The diagram looked like something that like Matthew McConaughey's character would make on the first season of True Detective, right? Yeah. Like, is this just
it
completely
even had a circle,
bizarre?
I think it was like a time is a intersectionality is a flat circle. Yeah. Right.
But the thing is so that has been used to completely obscure the actual policy differences that are, I mean, this is fundamentally a primary between a pretty left-wing politician and a centrist politician.
Yeah.
But there's no conversation about that actual policy difference because people are so busy performing a certain kind of progressive sort of stance. That's not like a mistake, right? Like that is like a it's sort of a tactic that the Hillary Clinton campaign has, to their credit, brilliantly run this whole campaign, which is you attack the commies not by talking about policy, but by sort of doing this sort of signaling. And that one of the things that's really pernicious about it and really gross about it is that the people who know how to do this are the people who are not the traditional constituency of the left, right? The left's constituency is the poor and the uneducated and the people who don't have social capital, right? One of the things, part of the reason why you pay REA for a Yale degree or a degree at Sarah Lawrence or Oberlin or Amherst is when you go there, you are taught the mores and the norms and the language of how to be a cool, woke, fuckable Brooklynite, you know, when you become a 24-year-old rather after you are a 22-year-old at college, right?
Well, I don't know in 2005, I don't know if that's what was going with my degree. But yeah, you are enculturated into the mores of the ruling class at, you know, at these elite schools. And mm-hmm. even though maybe if you were not, you know, I'm from a fairly middle class background, but you know, there were many wealthy people who I went to school with, and you kind of learn how to interact with these people
that's the key. Like you said it, Arya. Like the key is that is the ruling class, right?
Yeah.
Like the ruling class is no longer blue bloods who are socially conservative, right? Obviously there are social conservatives who are rich out there, but nowadays to be part of, if not like the actual ruling class in terms of having a lot of money, being part of the aspirational class that has the social capital necessary to move up,
yeah,
that is an assumed kind of socially and culturally liberal kind of framework. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So you are like changing your Facebook profile pic to a, you know, gay marriage sign or whatever. Well, obviously gay marriage is a wonderful development, right? But it's also something that has been demonstrated to fit perfectly in with the interests of the ruling class.
Right. No one in power loses out when, you know, when gay couples are allowed to marry. And in fact, the radical, you know, gay activists, their critique of gay marriage is that, you know, why are the people who are once radicals embracing this, you know, bourgeois institution that is oppressed, you know, oppressed women for millennia.
Right. And so one of the things, I mean, one narrative that you can see happening in this election is seeing a split between this could be the beginning of the split of the left, where economic justice is finally completely shorn from these anti-racism and sort of anti-racism and feminism and pro-gay rights kind of politics, where the sort of the identity politics and the sort of social and cultural politics, which of course I embrace, which of course I think are important, but where you have finally this division between them, where we walk completely away from the idea of economic justice, where we stop talking about redistribution, where we stop talking about the needs of everybody who's poor, where we say, you know, a laid off iron worker with a bad hip and two kids and an addiction to OxyContin, like that person doesn't deserve our compassion anymore because he's white and a male or whatever, right?
Yeah, and probably is a Trump supporter, which is, we can hold on to that for
right.
the final
but so,
topic here.
And so, I mean, the Hillary Clinton campaign is really cynically and really effectively leveraging sort of woke politics, right, against traditional left-wing concerns of economic justice, of redistribution, mm-hmm. of attacking finance, of undermining the power of corporations. And it's a scary time.
Okay, so I mentioned Trump a couple times. Let's just kind of make transition to a final topic. Okay. And so the link is, yeah, so this, you know, this imaginary, you know, auto worker you talked about is kind of the person who, in the stereotype, is of, you know, voting for Trump, and it's the reason he won Michigan, and, you know, has won, weirdly, you know, he won Massachusetts. I think he actually did better in Massachusetts than anywhere else so far. Mm-hmm. And he also, you know, but also won Mississippi, and people can't really understand that. And
he's consistently won with people who have postgraduate degrees.
Right. Strangely, for someone who is, you know, kind of proudly ignorant, and, you know, if he's running against, well, you know, the man did go to Wharton, which is a very fine business school, I hear. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so one of the weird things that's happened online is the growth of this group, the alt-right. And I talked about it in the previous episode that I mentioned with Ellie Reeve. And so I've been kind of feuding with some of these people online. And so, you know, so basically, if Freddie, I assume you maybe haven't listened to this conversation, just to recap it, you know, I tweeted something at Michael Brennan Doherty. He retweeted it. I suddenly got a lot of weird stuff coming at me that was like stuff about Jews belong in the ovens, kill yourself, weird memes that made no sense to me. You know, I kind of investigated, figured out there's this movement, the alt-right, we'll link to it. It linked information about it. Anyway. So I had this conversation with Ellie Reeve, and then I kind of went back to the original tweet of the people who started like yelling at me and saying, not like die Jew, but like, you know, here's a gif of a frog that's being put into an oven. You know, it's this weird kind of slanted, you know, bigotry. And I said to a bunch of these people just as basically trolling, and a few of them responded and went back and forth, and then most of them dropped off. But I ended up talking to this one guy, and I ended up having a pretty extensive direct message conversation with him. And I won't say who he is, and I didn't get his real name. He's anonymous online. He is it
Tom Watson?
No.
Is that it? Is it Peter Dow?
No. This is an alt-right. This is an alt-right person.
Oh, I see. All right.
This is someone with around 200 Twitter followers. This is someone who is a Trump supporter. This is an intelligent guy. He's actually, I talked a little bit about it. I won't reveal too much, but he is a college dropout. He lives in a big city in the Midwest. He's white, and he really feels like he's losing the country that he wants to live in. And right. He seems pretty young. I'm not quite sure, but probably my guess would be around 25. And I had an extensive conversation with him. And, you know, he is not a stupid person. He's smart. He was referencing, you know, things that, you know, the closing of the American frontier or whatever that famous essay is. And he is, you know, educated, even though he didn't get a college degree. But he really thought that Trump was going to kind of make, preserve the status of white people in America that he saw as being really under threat and really a major problem for America if the whites become a minority in this country. And so this guy, you know, I don't know if he would call himself a racist or an anti-Semite. You know, he knew that I was Jewish and was having an extensive conversation with me and was not saying, like, this was not one of the guys who was sending me, you know, Jews belong in ovens kind of stuff, but more like, I went back and realized that the thing that he actually just said to me was, why are you so afraid of Trump? When I said this initial thing that Michael Doherty retweeted and brought my existence to the attention of a lot of these people. And
we should note that Michael Brendan Doherty is not part of the alt-right and is not an anti-Semite.
No. Michael Brandoni, a friend of Blogging Heads,
and a good guy.
Yeah, and he is someone who is kind of called himself for a while anti-Trump. Someone who's trying to explicate to the larger conservative movement the reasons why people support Trump. And so, you know, I had a conversation with this guy, an interesting guy, intelligent. What do you make of all this?
So there's a few things to say here. To begin with, I think it's interesting the way that American nativists and racists kind of coincide or intersect with some of the more kind of optimistic and Pollyanna-ish people on the left, which is this notion of our coming demographic victory, that the left will win because the non-white portion of the American electorate is growing and non-white people tend to vote for liberal causes and Democrats. Mm-hmm. To begin with, the demographic trends are not as clear as they once were. For example, when the American economy tanked, Mexican immigrants stopped coming into the country, which should make sense, you know. I'm in favor of open borders, so whatever. Anyway, it's probably, you know, in 2012, the American presidential electorate was about 70% white. And this notion, both on the part of Trump supporters who are so afraid for no reason that they're going to become like the new underclass, you still have a dominant majority, right? White people are still a dominant majority. To partisan Democrats who talk about, oh, we don't even have to do anything anymore. We're just going to, you know, just wait for time to win. Again, 70% of the voters in this election are going to be white, just about maybe 65-70%. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we only pay attention to white people's interests, obviously. But it does mean that, like, just saying we can just rest on our laurels and wait for demographic change to save us is fucking stupid. It's idiocy. So I do not excuse, and I do not think that economic conditions excuse racism or nativism. I think that anyone that is supporting Trump's more sort of outlandish proposals and who knows that Trump is stoking nativism and racism is someone that I don't care to have in my coalition. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people, probably a majority of people in the Donald Trump support base who are just bad people who I'm not interested in wooing.
Right.
However, I wrote this recently. You know, Stokely Carmichael, who was a great civil rights and black nationalist leader in the late 60s and 1970s, said, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. If a white man has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way of kind of brute pragmatism, if 30 people support Donald Trump for president, that's their problem. If 30 million people support Donald Trump for president, that's our problem, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Simply the fact that so much nativist sentiment, so much angry quasi or proto-fascist sentiment has been whipped up is a problem that the left must confront.
Yeah.
And there's far too many people on the left who are just saying, oh, they're all crazy, racist white people. We don't have to care about them.
Yeah.
Actually, when there's as many people in your country who are as angry as they are, you do have to care about them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like their existence and their power, their political power and their numbers is a problem no matter how you confront it.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think that plenty of them are just kind of irredeemable racists, I also think that there's a lot of people in the Trump coalition who are scared, who are facing very genuine and very deep economic distress, and who are supporting Trump because they felt that they played by the rules and have been screwed by the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, working class Americans have played by the rules by and large in vast numbers, and they have been screwed by our system. You know, again, like you mentioned the divide, the great divide in 1979, when for decades you can follow the path of sort of productivity and wages, and they go up together, mm-hmm. and they split. The degree to which all of the economic progress of this country of the last 35 years have been captured by the wealthiest is insane, and it's indicative of a broken system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one place where you and I disagree is I believe that that is simply endemic to capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. That massive inequality is, in fact, the purpose of capitalism, and that's why we need to find a post-capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
But one way or the other, you've got all these people who look around them. I mean, look, you know, my best friend is a guy who's one of my best friends is a guy whose father only had a high school education, but he went to the proverbial factory at the edge of town. He worked his way up from being a guy on the assembly line to an engineer. He has a wife who doesn't work. He's raised three sons. He put them all to college. He bought a house. He had multiple cars. That was something that was possible, right? Yeah. That was the American dream. Uh-huh. My friend who has a college degree, has worked on everything right, and has worked really hard, has had a series of low-paying jobs that he doesn't like, right? That is the story of so many people in America. And it's even worse if you don't have a college degree.
Right.
Trump supporters, some of them, are awful people that I don't want. Some of them are scared people who have had the wool pulled over their eyes by a very effective demagogue. And we should want to woo the ones who can be wooed and bring them over into our coalition, not because we excuse racism or nativism, but because we should have compassion for everyone, including people who are really hurting in a very, very deep way, yeah. Even when they're white, even if they have ended up voting in a primary for a very awful guy. And I think that there are people who can be peeled off of that coalition if they can be convinced, if they can come to see that what's in their best interest is also in the best interest, what's also in the best interest of an unemployed Mexican immigrant in Yuma, of a unemployed black guy in Flint, Michigan, of a single mother with children on food stamps in Bakersfield, California. Mm-hmm. Right? Capital's oldest trick, the oldest trick of establishment power of capital, of the bourgeois, right, of the rentier class, is by pitting different versions of poor people, different kinds of poor people against each other,
right,
rather than having them recognize their cross-class solidarity.
Right. And I think this is actually a point I raised in our previous conversation about a year ago, which is that one interpretation of American racism is the white people turned the poor white people and the black people, poor black people, against each other, so that those two groups would not unite against the rich white people.
Look at the history of the American labor movement, right? It happened all the time that when the factory unions would strike, the bosses would deliberately seek out scabs from black neighborhoods, right? Mm-hmm. You go to black neighborhoods, you find people who have, because of racism, because of Jim Crow, because of the hideous legacy of America, who have been cut out of the economy and who desperately need work. You attract them with jobs of being scabs. You then bring them to the factory, right? Then the union sees the scabs and they direct their animus at black people, mm-hmm. right? And so that is capital doing what it does best.
Yeah,
right?
It's really interesting you say that, because one of this individual who I was talking to, this alt guy who considers himself, or you know, is part of the alt-right, one of his big things was like, you know, Mexican labor is flooding in, and he also had a weird interest in Asian, you know, cheap Asian labor coming in, and you know they can undercut us, and you know I'm never going to be able to get a good job, or my kids are never going to get a good job, because there will always be a Mexican immigrant who is willing to work for less.
Just to respond to him, after the financial crisis, undocumented immigration from Mexico into this country collapsed,
right?
Because the housing industry collapsed, and because undocumented Mexican day laborers were sort of responsive to the job market. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the point that needs to be made to people on the left, which is it's not victory for anyone if an undocumented American immigrant, if an undocumented Mexican immigrant comes here and picks strawberries for $3 a day, right? Like, that is him coming and being exploited. Now, if you ask me what we need to do, we need to eliminate the fiction that is the nation state and eliminate the borders, in which case we don't have this problem, right? But
that's a few years away, at least.
That's maybe 6 months to 6 months to a year away.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with this, you know, the New York State primary.
But look, what is immiserating both your alt-right friend, right,
right,
and the guy from Mexico, is the fact that, you know, capitalism is producing, as it always does, a certain rate of growth, an enviable rate of growth, although that rate of growth is slowed compared to where it was once. Mm-hmm. That rate of growth should result in a certain amount of productivity and a certain amount of income for everybody. But it doesn't, because the system is set up in such a way so that the vast majority of those gains go to the people at the very top. Mm-hmm. The alt-right guy isn't immiserated because the Mexican guy's cutting is undercutting him. The alt-right guy is losing out because the people at the top who are making absurd, obscene amounts of wealth are capturing all the money so nobody else has any.
Yeah.
80% of global income is captured by 20% of the people, right?
Right.
1%, 61 million people, controls more wealth and income than something like 40% of the world's people, right? And that's where the money's gone. And what the guy who from the alt-right has to understand is it makes no sense to – I mean, just like it, completely outside of ideology or politics. It makes no sense to look at the poor Mexican guy who came across the border looking for work, who makes, you know, $15 a day or whatever it is that he makes, who has no social capital, who has no political power, who it can be let go at any moment, who has no security whatsoever. And to look at that person and say, you're the source of my problem, is irrational. Right. It's irrational in the most basic terms. What is rational is to look at the pooba at the top of the corporation who is raking in millions of dollars a year, whose kids will never have to work a day in their lives, who is just being more and more greedy and getting what he wants. And he's the one who says, you know what? Even though we're making an incredibly healthy profit and our company's profit is pocketing, you know, millions of dollars, and even though I'm incredibly wealthy, we still need to find a way to find cheaper labor. Yeah. That person is your enemy. The Mexican guy, who the undocumented Mexican worker, he is your class compatriot because he is also being immiserated in the same way that you're being immiserated.
Right. And so something, you know, kind of bring this full circle, you know, this individual, this guy, in a different reality, in a reality where Donald Trump decided that he would rather go play golf all year than running for president, you can see this guy being attracted by Bernie Sanders' message. And for I don't know why this particular individual, maybe because he actually does have a lot more racist beliefs than, so he can't identify with the Democrats because he sees them as the party that is just working on the behalf of, you know, non-white people who are poor.
Which is always a strong possibility, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just plain old racism is always a possibility.
Yes, but this guy in another reality or with a slightly different set of circumstances could be a Bernie Sanders supporter. And so why don't we end with this question? You know, so Sanders has obviously gone a lot farther than I thought he would, probably mm-hmm. than he thought he would. And it's unfortunate that for the left that Hillary Clinton is going to win 48 states in the fall. You know, what do you think is the future of this movement? Bernie Sanders is not going to be the next president. He is kind of a old Jewish grandpa from Brooklyn. He is not a very good like politician in the way that like Bill Clinton is a good politician, like glad handing and you know giving good speeches. Like, do you see
and serial harassing women like he does?
Yeah, I mean, he sticks his finger right in the women's face, and then you know the Bernie Bros just
no. I'm talking about Bill Clinton serially sexually harassing.
Oh right. Okay, yeah. So Bill Clinton, the actual sexual predator, and the Bernie Bros. Who do you see people on the horizon who can take up this mantle like in 2024 or whatever?
So Matt Iglesias wrote a good piece about this, and for the record, I did just say that Matt Iglesias wrote a good piece. So I want that noted for the record, because sometimes he does. The Democrats are in real trouble, and the Democrats are in real trouble because they only get up – they only have the infrastructure in place to get up for the presidential election, because a lot of the Democratic base only seems to care when it's the glamour of the presidential election.
Right.
But unfortunately for them arguably, state politics are more important for the actual lives of actual people than national politics.
Yeah.
And state politics determines congressional politics, because if you control the state houses, then you can gerrymander and you can decide who becomes a representative. And I've read – I'm not going to get the figure right, but on the state level Democrats have lost something like 900 seats.
That's a number I've read as well. So yeah, all told, like, you know, state legislatures and stuff, there's been a huge turn towards the Republicans since 2010.
They've been getting absolutely just hammered. Mm-hmm. And there's no plan on the Democrat side. There's no idea about how to fight this. And everyone is just so obsessed with capturing the presidency. But capturing the presidency doesn't matter as much if you can't pass an agenda because you can't control the House and because you have all these hostile state legislatures. Uh-huh. The Bernie Sanders revolution, whatever, is not about Sanders, right? I mean, he's a great sort of, he seems like a great human. He and I have our differences on Israel and guns and, you know, whether we should put people to the guillotine or not. But he is
so he's captured. He's con guillotine, just for the record?
He's anti-guillotine.
Okay, yeah.
The thing is, this wouldn't be happening if shit wasn't fucked up and bullshit. And the thing is, like,
well put.
Even outside of, like, all the, like, the hustle and flow of partisan politics, people are gravitating to Bernie Sanders' message because things are fucked up and bullshit.
Yeah.
And as long as things are fucked up and bullshit, there is going to be space for a radical left-wing politics because people know that the system isn't working.
Yeah.
And so the question is not, will Bernie Sanders become president? He might, but he probably won't. Mm-hmm. The question is, do we have what it takes to build a durable, long-term left-wing movement that can attack via partisan politics when we need to, like right now with the Bernie Sanders campaign, with labor organizing, if we can reinvigorate the labor movement, like through the Fight for 15 movement, which is the most exciting thing to happen in labor organizing in my lifetime, and through street-level activism like Black Lives Matter. These movements are coming together because the system is stacked against regular people, and regular people have started to notice. And as on the one hand, while things like the Panama Papers demonstrate that, you know, the rich usually get what they want, if I was someone who was really deeply dedicated to preserving the class hierarchy of the United States, I'd be worried, because I really do think that there's a chance that we're going to start a durable and meaningful left-wing movement in the near future.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the people are out there. They're waiting for their what's the word I'm looking for? Not paladin. You know, they're waiting for their leader to come forth. Maybe like Tulsi Gabbard. I don't know if you followed the career of this young.
Is she the one who's really anti-Muslim?
No. She's a congressperson from Hawaii. She endorsed Sanders.
Mm.
And she is, like, you know, the future of America kind of person, like multiracial, right. Very bright. She endorsed Sanders, strangely, you know, one of the few elected representatives who endorsed Sanders. And I thought she can kind of see what's coming. She, you know, she knows that maybe in 2020, 2024, there's going to be a spot for someone, you know, someone like her.
Right.
Okay, there's one final...
Unfortunately,
sorry, go ahead.
She is a crazy Islamophobe.
Oh, okay.
that is the flaw in her politics from my perspective.
Well,
so, anyway.
From the perspective of winning the American presidency, it might not be a flaw. So just one final thing to really bring this full circle. So, you know, I think the reason you have become such a critic of this woke politics kind of bullshit is that you see this as the distraction, you know, the shiny object that getting white people who are all basically liberals or leftists to attack each other instead of, like, going after the class interest. And I just want to bring up one thing that, you know, happened, I observed in the, like, non-political world as an example of this. So my wife is part of a Facebook group that's kind of about exercise, and someone posted on this group, you know, a regular person just posting on Facebook, you know, I want to do yoga, but I really feel like it's cultural appropriation, and I really Roomba, I went to some Roomba
Zumba.
Class. Zumba.
Roomba is a robot.
Oh, right, yeah, that's the vacuuming robot. Yeah, I went to a Zumba class. You know, that's like appropriating Argentinian culture, and, like, you know, what should I really do? What is what, like, a way I can, like, exercise in a healthy way that isn't, like, culturally, you know, making me, like, a cultural appropriator? And so it kind of, like, there was a big argument that was started on this Facebook group of all, you know, these are not political people. They're just people interested in healthy exercise. And you know, it's, you know, I just was like, what's, you know, I thought of you, and I thought of, like, you know, this woman thinks she's doing something good. She thinks that by not going to yoga, she is somehow doing something good. But she, like, how can we convince these people that, like, this is not politics? You're not engaging in politics right now. And, like, you need, if you want to do something, engage in politics. Don't, like, be fretting on Facebook about whether or not your yoga practice is offensive towards, like, you know, people in India.
Part of the thing that I find dangerous about this is also one of the reasons why I have hope about this, which is she, and no offense to this individual person, but that she is likely embracing this because it's a fad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things about the sort of performative left wing intersectional politics is that it is shallow, and it is shallow because it is a way, again, to demonstrate your social value, which means that it is subject to the sort of ebb and flow of sort of a faddishness. Mm-hmm. And I do think that eventually people will tire of this and we will move past the sort of faddish politics and get to the actual heart of left-wing organizing.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, that's the hope. And, you know, the people who, like I've said multiple times recently, if you are arguing about politics on Twitter, like, you are a strange individual. And the average person does not pay attention to politics really at all.
Did you see that census poll from 2013?
No.
75% of it says, like, how often do you express a political opinion online? 75% said never. The number of people, percentage of people who express a political opinion online every day is 2%.
Right. So it can seem like this is the
people
real
like
world.
You and me. Yeah.
It's a bunch of weirdos. It's the equivalent of people who, you know, are doing like sabermetrics in their basement, but with politics instead of sports. So, you know, there's this whole world of normal people who are going about their lives and are too busy to care about all this bullshit. And then, like, occasionally these people pay attention for a couple hours to go vote every year because they feel like it's their civic duty. But like, the real Twitter is not the real world. You know, this is, most people are not paying attention to politics. Anyway, this is why I basically think Donald Trump is doomed and, you know, the Republican Party is possibly going to crack up. But, you know, Clinton is definitely going to win because people who don't pay attention to politics are like, Trump, this guy's a joke and a madman. But yeah, so that, you know, go outside and go talk to some people in real life and stop listening to Blogging Heads.
Right. And drink a beer.
Yeah. Cheers. Okay. So, Freddie, this has been really interesting. I think everyone will enjoy it. Thanks for coming on. We'll provide all those links that we mentioned below. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. Freddie, do you want anything in specifically you want to plug, or we will link to your blog and your Twitter and all other ways people can find your stuff?
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, talk to you later.
Later.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.